The story of David's fight against Goliath is narrated in two significantly different versions. 32 verses in many manuscripts of the Greek Septuagint text, and 58 verses in manuscripts belonging to the Masoretic tradition. In addition, 2 Samuel 21:19, which forms part of a closing appendix to the books of Samuel, attributes the slaying of Goliath to someone named Elhanan ben Ya'are Oragim. Given that the books of Samuel were a single composition, how are we to account for this inconsistency? The author of 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, has noted it and tried to remedy the perceived problem through harmonization by having Elhanan, the son of Yair, kill Goliath's brother, Lahmi. This story of the killing of Goliath offers an excellent case study that can provide insight into how the same set of facts can be given different interpretations on the basis of one set of starting assumptions, use of methods that go with that, from the perspectives of orality, scribalism, and cultural memory. So we'll begin with orality. Recognition that portions of the biblical text likely derive from oral tradition has been widespread for over a century, since Hermann Gunkel's Study of Folk Tales in the Hebrew Bible, written in 1917, which we already have had a nice summary of. Given that the majority of the population would have been illiterate, stories about past leaders, kings, heroes, and memorable individuals and events likely would have been told or sung and performed in villages, towns, and at the royal court. Within folklore studies, two criteria appear to be commonly accepted in formulating a working definition of the focus of investigation. Tradition and oral transmission. As summarized by Patricia Kirkpatrick, who also was summarized in Jean-Louis' paper, the understanding of transmission has shifted over time within the discipline to emphasize less a process where a pure oral text has been handed down uninfluenced by the written word, to a process that includes the inevitable interchange between oral and written forms of communication, and also to tradition as a dynamic force that is continually updated and expressed in mixed media within a given community, which includes ones in industrial and urbanized settings. Folklorist Hedda Jason has undertaken an analysis of the longer and shorter versions of the story of David and Goliath from the perspective of the genres of heroic folk fairy tale and romantic epic to determine to determine to which genre it is closer. She uses the model of Vladimir Propp for the heroic fairy tale genre and the one of Alexander Skatyevmov for the national epic, of which the romantic epic is a subgenre. A few main differences distinguish the two genres, which otherwise can overlap in many story components. There is a strong supernatural element in the fairy tale, and the hero's reward for overcoming the villain is marriage to the king's daughter. While in the epic, the actors are all human, and the hero's reward for defeating the enemy is joining the king's court. In the romantic subgenre, the hero wins the hand of the princess as well, making it overlap with the first, and also supernatural elements can enter into this subgenre very easily. So it looks very much like a heroic, can look very much like a heroic fairy tale. The organization of events on concurrent time axes, which takes place actually in chapter 17, verse 19, is rare in the fairy tale, but common in the epic. Also typical of national and historic epic is conflict that takes place in a border region between our land and their land, as here in the Valley of Elah. In both plot lines, the hero cannot belong to the existing group of the king's heroes and can only be recognized by the king after his heroic act. Usually as well, the king has no sons. Even though 1 Samuel 18:1 through 5 fall outside the framework of the fairy tale structure, David's joining the royal court, receiving Saul's clothing, and winning of Jonathan's friendship in these verses can be seen to be part of the typical epic heroic reward. In Jason's considered view, when the additional verses in the Masoretic text are assumed to be original and part of that text, the longer text can be classified as a romantic epic, which is, again, a subgenre of the historic epic, constituting a short prose record of an ethno-poetic work. The shorter Septuagint version, on the other hand, lacks vital plot elements that prevent it from standing as an independent folkloric tale. The first problem is the contradiction in verses 33 through 41 that are introduced in those verses to the preceding storyline in 1 Samuel 16, where David already is Saul's weapon bearer, so at least he is a soldier in training. The second discrepancy is the absence in the Septuagint of the author of the king's daughter in marriage, which is a vital element in both the fairy tale and the heroic epic. Jason concludes the Septuagint version is an abridgment of the longer Masoretic form, made in order to avoid duplication and conflict within the larger storyline in 1 Samuel. David already is a member of the court in 1 Samuel 16, and he subsequently marries Saul's daughter Michal in chapter 18, but that's after being set a separate task, presenting 100 Philistine foreskins to Saul in order to win her hand. Another important consequence of assuming oral tradition to underlie the story of David's slaying of Goliath is the common view that Elhanan's slaying of Goliath in 2 Samuel 21:19 reflects an earlier form of the tradition than the story of David's killing of Goliath. It is recognized in folklore and oral tradition that feats tend to be transferred from lesser individuals to well-known ones over time. Both warriors were remembered to have been from Bethlehem, providing a possible common point facilitating the transfer of the story in a process Benjamin Griffin has called narrative drift. Some seek an alternate solution to the problem that two different individuals are credited with slaying Goliath by proposing that Elhanan was David's given birth name before he was crowned and gained a new throne name. They seem to be grasping at straws, however. David is the son of Jesse, and Elhanan the son of Yaareh Oragim or Ya'ari. These two are meant to be two separate individuals, even if, as already noted, they share in common a connection to the town of Bethlehem. Two, scribalism. There have been many studies of scribal education and techniques in ancient Judah and Yehud. Although little definitive is known about scribal training due to a lack of evidence, it is widely acknowledged that the authors of the biblical texts would have drawn on oral tradition, as well as archival material, would have used set literary patterns, type scenes, stock characters, as well as their own imagination and ideology to produce the texts before us. In addition, it is a standard assumption that the current final forms of these books include further modifications arising from deliberate editorial work that included additions, alterations, and inadvertent scribal errors in copying over the centuries, which extant manuscripts demonstrate. The identification of underlying oral tradition is not, however, a simple, straightforward task, as we have seen already. Many of the techniques used in the composition of orally delivered stories, sagas, and epics are used to good effect in composing literature. And as pointed out by Susan Neidich, we also just heard a little about, The various compositions in the Hebrew Bible reflect traits typically associated with orally composed works, even if it cannot be proven that they were composed orally. Oral and written composition form a continuum. There have been two approaches used to account for the two different forms of the story of David and Goliath. Either the Septuagint represents an earlier form of the story that was expanded to yield the present Masoretic text, or the Masoretic text contains an earlier form of the story that was cut back to create the shorter version found in the Greek. The view that the Septuagint preserves the earlier form has been most popular among scholars, who cite the tendency of text to be expanded over time by scribes and copyists. Different schemes have been proposed to account for an initial expansion of the short form of the story, with one or more subsequent smaller additions. It is common to suggest that a second independent version of the story has been inserted somewhat clumsily into the Septuagint version to produce the current Masoretic form. Advocates of this dominant understanding, however, have not provided an adequate explanation for why scribes would have introduced deliberate contradictions into the larger storyline of the Book of Samuel. Many seem to assume that a desire to preserve a variant form of the story would have outweighed any concern for literary coherence in the larger story about David's career in 1 and 2 Samuel. In the Masoretic story, David is not Saul's weapons bearer or musician, even though he has taken on positions in both of those positions in the immediately preceding chapter 16, and their explanations of how each came about. Graham Auld and Craig Ho have argued that the Septuagint was expanded in order to lead the audience to reflect more readily over the contrast between the first two kings, Saul and David, by providing parallel story patterning that would lead one to have such reflective activity. They reject the proposal that there was a second independent story of this event that was inserted into the shorter Septuagint version in chunks. Instead, they propose new information has been developed creatively on the basis of prior story elements in Saul's rise to kingship, which is narrated in 1 Samuel 9:1 through 10:16. However, it's commonly acknowledged that the story of Saul they are using for comparison is itself a truncated folktale. The elements they refer to are typically used to develop folkloric plot lines. All of these elements can be seen to derive from the presentation of the battle between David and Goliath in the Masoretic version as an independent romantic epic, where they are integral and necessary elements. So you can't prove in any way that these elements have been derived from the story about Saul. 3, cultural memory. While the historical liability of any or all parts of a memory can be investigated in some disciplines, it cannot in the field of Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. We lack the necessary documentation to trace versions of a memory back systematically to an originating source, and then to track its divergent development through time and in different social groups or geographical locations. Thus, the text-critical enterprise that seeks to determine whether the Masoretic text or the Septuagint text preserves an earlier or, quote, unquote, more original form of the text just examined under the scribalism section is not relevant from a cultural or social memory perspective. Instead, these two texts can read as different received versions of a memory that can provide insight into how it likely informed and shaped the needs of group identity in different early Judean communities. So if we start with the Septuagint text, the Septuagint is widely assumed to have been created in Alexandria in Egypt. It is thought that the Book of Samuel was translated into Greek in the 100s before the Common Era from a Hebrew text that already differed from the one underlying the Masoretic text. Jews in Alexandria tended to be Hellenized and cosmopolitan. Many no doubt would have been familiar with Homer or some of the episodes recounted in the Iliad and the Odyssey and its ideals of manliness. After all, these works form the basis of a classical education. In the Septuagint, we find a tale that focuses on representative combat between two heroes, a variation on Homeric practice, albeit with a Judean twist. David is present at the battle among the personnel, perhaps as Saul's weapon bearer, which he already has become in chapter 16. The normal battle taunts are exchanged, but the opponents select different weapons and therefore different engagement tactics. Goliath is characterized as a huge man with protective covering over most of his body. He's got armor, a helmet, and leg greaves. And he uses the traditional Greek weaponry of a sword, spear, a javelin, and a shield, here carried by a weapons bearer. The handout has the Septuagint version on one side and the Masoretic on the other, en français. At the same time, however, the excessive weight of these items limits his mobility. He is dependent upon close hand-to-hand combat, where he can count on his size, strength, and the force of the heavy weapons to be able to kill his opponent. David recognizes the futility of meeting Goliath on his own terms, dressed in armor with conventional weapons. Such a contest would lead to the certain death of anyone who would take on hand-to-hand combat with this hulk of a man. Instead, David understands success depends on using a more advantageous combat strategy, felling his opponent from a distance with a well-aimed slingshot strike. In Semitic practice, the slingshot was a recognized weapon of war. Assyrian armies contained regiments of slingers as a standard practice. And here we earlier were hearing about Lachish. The siege of Lachish in 701 featured slingers, and we actually have retrieved the slingshot, the balls outside the walls at Lachish. The Greeks used it in combat as well. Oh, sorry, this also from Tel Halaf in Syria shows another slinger already known in 900 BCE. But with the Greeks, we have this use of a sling in an early siege warfare on a silver rhyton from Mycenae that dates to 1600 to 1500 BCE. Is that the last one of those? Yeah. In Homer, even though there is no mention of slingers as a military unit active in the Trojan War, there is indirect evidence. In the Iliad, chapter 13, Agenor removes a spear from a comrade's hand. And then he uses a sling made of twisted sheep's wool that a squire is carrying to bind the hand to staunch the flow of blood. In addition, 12 wounds are reported to have been caused by stones in the Iliad and Odyssey combined, with a 67% mortality rate. A Hellenized Jewish audience familiar with the Iliad, who had heard or read this story of David and Goliath, might well have seen David as a second Paris, a beautiful and inexperienced youth, two traits considered unheroic in the Homeric Greek tradition. They might have reacted to the report of David's initial putting on of Saul's armor with apprehension, knowing how such a disguise could backfire, as it had in the case of young Patrocles, who disguised himself as Achilles by wearing Achilles' armor and ended up dead at the hand of Hector. If so, they would have expressed a sigh of relief when David discarded the armor and faced Goliath on his own terms. At the same time, however, they would have appreciated the irony set up in the story. They could readily see David's strategic battle plan and his real chances of success, even if his lumbering Philistine opponent and the king of Israel could not. The story portrays David as someone who thinks creatively and outside the box, and so is able to outwit his opponent by not accepting the game rules set forth by the other, but changing them to his advantage. This portrayal values intelligence over brawn. Turning to the longer Masoretic account, what impact do the additional verses have on the story, and how would that preserve a different memory for a Judean community located in Yehud, who did not know Homer? Their lack of familiarity with the scenes of one-to-one combats in the Iliad would not have precluded their appraisal of the strengths and weaknesses of the two styles of fighting, and seeing that David was not foolhardy in taking on Goliath. This version focuses much more on David's family background, on his status as a youth who was at the battle coincidentally or providentially, delivering food supplies to his three eldest brothers and getting family news to report back to his father, Jesse the Ephrathite from Bethlehem. If read as a self-contained unit, the story introduces David as a new character and provides the set of three rewards as an incentive for his being willing to take on Goliath: wealth, marriage to one of Saul's daughters, and a tax-free status. The narrator has Saul send for David, which is consistent with the requirement in both a romantic epic and a heroic fairy tale that the young hero should not be part of the king's court, but a total outsider. Note that no rewards are contained in the Greek version. Eliab's characterization of David as being overly presumptuous or overconfident, Zadon, and having evil or bad thoughts in his heart, would be intended to portray David as perhaps a thrill-seeking daredevil type. David's confidence that Yahweh will protect him would then illustrate his overconfidence more generally, which his elder brother finds objectionable. His delivery of Goliath's head to Saul afterward is a further detail consistent with his confident cockiness. The summarizing verse 50 highlights David as an Israelite hero whose strategic thinking and confidence allowed him to perform the first of many heroic feats. Oh, well, sorry, I'm off by one. We just described that. Okay. The final five verses at the beginning of chapter 18 provide the needed reward and ending to the epic romantic hero story, though not one that is fully satisfactory. David is made a member of the royal court, he becomes friends with the heir elect to the throne, Jonathan, and he is clothed in royal robes. However, in terms of the three promised rewards earlier in the story, he does not marry Saul's daughter, his family is not given tax-free status, and he is not wealthy in any conventional sense of the word, although one might argue the royal clothing fulfills this promise metonymically. Here it is logical to suspect some sort of truncating adaptation of the end of the story to accommodate its present location, as we find also in the folktale involving Saul in 1 Samuel 9:1 through 10:16. Concluding observations. One's starting assumptions concerning the impact of orality, scribalism, and cultural memory on the two versions of David's battle with Goliath affect one's ultimate conclusions about how and why the two versions developed. From a folkloristic standpoint, only the Masoretic version is a complete literary work that reflects the plot elements of a romantic epic. The Septuagint is likely an abridged version adapted to its present context in the plotline of 1 Samuel. The Masoretic version could have been read or told on its own, and perhaps belonged to a collection of stories that circulated independently about David. The books of Samuel do not contain all such stories that existed. Among the 13 psalm headings that link specific psalms to events in David's life, Psalm 7 refers to an incident that is not in the book of Samuel, or in that, for that matter, in any other book in the Hebrew Bible. We are unaware of Cush the Benjaminite. While Psalm 56 seems to assume a different version of events than what is currently narrated in 1 Samuel 21, 10 through 15. Both stories must have been part of a larger collection about David that was in circulation and was known to those who read the Psalms and added the superscriptions. The Masoretic story of David and Goliath could also have been part of this collection before it was added into the book of Samuel. The shorter version of the Septuagint might be drawing on a known David saga or cycle as well. But if so, a scribe has deliberately omitted or reshaped standard story elements in it in order to adapt it to other patterns that are shaping the larger narrative in Samuel. Thank you.